integrity. That's called courage.
Free up your mind. Use your imagination.
All you need to know is I'll get you there.
Learning.
Now that's the stuff leaders should be made of.
Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Our guests are our students. Opinionated, daring, and ridiculously smart. They ask tough questions about life and about learning. This podcast is by them and for them.
Thank you so much, Parikshit and Kriti, for joining us for the first episode of the Open House Podcast. The last year has been both a good year and a bad year for mental health. A bad year because I think more people have struggled with mental health, and good because there's never been a better time to talk about this, and we've never spoken more openly about these things. And I think at some point in the year, each of us asked ourselves this question, how do you support your friend if they are depressed? And that is going to be the main question that we sort of like tackle in this podcast. Parikshit is in class 12 at St. Xavier's Collegiate School in Calcutta. He runs his own NGO across four countries called the EduGreen Initiative. And he loves all things design thinking and politics. He hopes to be a political strategist someday. Kriti is a licensed counselor who specializes in child and relationship counseling. She is an alumna of Johns Hopkins University and also the founder of Mind the Gap, a services and psychoeducational venture that talks about mental health. Before we actually deep dive into our central question, I want to start off with just the first question to Parikshit, which is how openly do you talk about mental health with your friends? And a follow-up to Kriti, how do you create safe spaces and how do you make sure that conversation about this can happen freely?
So getting started on that, I think I'm going to take it a little tangentially, primarily because if I'm talking about how openly do I talk about the issues I'm facing, then I'm quite open about that. Especially during the lockdown itself, because my parents haven't been in town. They've been in Delhi the entire while. So the last 8 months, they've been in Delhi. So most of the interactions that I've had have essentially been with my friends or with my seniors. And I've really gotten closer to them as compared to what I used to be, whether it's about school, whether it's about extracurriculars, whether it's about friends fighting with each other and I'm being trapped in the middle of it. So I think I'm quite open about that, much more open than I used to be. But if I'm talking about how often do we discuss mental health in general in a more macro sense, I think that's a conversation that doesn't usually happen with most of my peers. So although I'm fine with talking about it, and there are people who talk a lot about it and at a very extensive level, at least within my peer circle, and I think this is true for most peer circles, that most people are not open to talk about it or even consider it as something that's worth a discussion. However, is there an openness about people talking about their own issues with friends that they have an understanding with? Then yes, there is a level of openness at a more microscopic and personal level.
How, if I were to look at, you know, a friend circle and how I can create a space which is, you know, safe and trusting in terms of having a conversation about mental health, I think the first thing is stop being vocal about things which you don't know. That's something that's really, really important, because it's okay for you to not know something and then just ask, hey, what is it that you're going through, or is it this that you're going through? And then being vocal about, okay, I know about this, I've heard about this, I know this is a tough time, do you want to talk about it? So there are two flip sides of the same thing. First, getting educated about what is it that's you know, at hand, and then talking about it in a more as I said, trained and educated manner. You know, talking about the topic that we have at hand, which is depression, and it's something that really, you know, fascinates me, because we very, very casually, we just say, oh, I'm so depressed today, and that's not it at all. So that's when we stop saying, hey, it's not depression, it's sadness, or it's momentary upset, whatever, and that's not depression, and, you know, not using slangs, you know, mental health diagnosis as slangs and passing it on as just to be cool.
How do you actually create that opportunity also, right? What do you know to look for? When do you ask, hey, are you going through a tough time?
Well, I think that's a great question. Frankly speaking, you have to be able to be aware of what's happening in someone else's life without being a nosy friend. That's a really thin line to draw. And I often say, don't check in once in a month. check in once in a week, check in and have real conversations. I think it's about time, and 2020 has taught us enough to know that, hey, it's time to have like real conversations. And if you're struggling, don't just do it for the Instagram, you know, like have a conversation, pick up your phone and talk to your friend. And that's something very intrinsic, like not another person can build it. Yes, I can give you that space to talk about your mental health, but only you would want to be able to have a conversation with me. I can't force you to have a conversation, because that's when I'm like poking you for gossip. Like, hey, is there something wrong? Is there something that's not cool? Discussing that, hey, I'm here to have a conversation. And if there is something that you're going through, I might not know about it, but I'm going to go and read up and be able to help you a little bit. And specifically for this generation, I don't want to sound ancient here, but technology is so useful, you know, having the access to go on Instagram pages which are talking about mental health, you know, connect with influencers who've, you know, gone through mental health issues by themselves and learning or being influenced, pick up a TED Talk and have a conversation about that TED Talk. You know, these are really simple conversational starters, which we can sort of indulge and make it okay to have that conversation instead of discussing like the weather and COVID vaccine, frankly.
But I actually like to build on what Kriti was just saying, especially when you're talking about Instagram pages. I think there's this other aspect to using technology to supposedly create these spaces where we are just creating social media echo chambers, where everyone just coming and telling us, hey, it is fine to talk to me, but these are absolute strangers. And for some reason, there is this element that, okay, there's a lot of activism that's happening around mental health, but then no one really means it. Or maybe they mean it for a specific 3 to 4 people. And yet there is this other end where people are expecting that, okay, there's going to be a lot of people to hear their story out. There's going to be a lot of people who are going to receive what they want to say. And that sometimes just isn't true. Or some of my juniors have Instagram pages who are going for mental health and they're discussing that. And sometimes there's always this feeling that, okay, it's fine that you're talking about it, but maybe you can't just have that authority and be like, I'm going to be the person who you can come and always talk to. Because most of the time, most people aren't mature enough to handle that discussion. And it just creates this false sense of expectation and hope that apparently there's going to be a number of people who are always there to listen to you. So are we creating these echo chambers? I think that's one major issue that we are always facing. Especially, I had this one friend, we were just scrolling through Instagram, we were sitting beside each other, and she suddenly came and said, oh, on your stories, I don't see any mental health pages on any of your stories. And I'm like, yeah, I don't follow a lot of them, and that's fine. And he's like, oh, my feed is entirely filled with one-line quote posts and a lot of these mental health pages as well. And I'm like, fine, that's fair. And that's when I realized that, okay. And what I essentially understood from that point is that it's just how Instagram works. It always keeps giving you the content that you're always looking for. And there's always this false expectation that if you're engaging with one sort of content and that, okay, maybe you're engaging only in mental health pages, you're creating this entire false ecosystem around yourself, which is of entirely false support. And sometimes that really isn't true. So I think that's one downside of using Instagram and social media and other forms of technology to even try to create these safe spaces where we might be just doing the exact opposite of it.
In terms of, I understand how the algorithm works, and I understand that, you know, Instagram is going to feed you what you've been searching for. And that's necessarily just any technology for you, which is related to social media. At that point, I always say that, you know, it's important for the consumer to be aware of what they're consuming, and not be, you know, following and taking a word from an account which is clearly like a run by a 15-year-old, you know, or someone who is enthusiastic about mental health but does not have a training or a background in. It's almost like when you see an account, and I know I'm getting into the nitty-gritties, but when you see an account, you can understand whether this is a professional running this page, or it's like a student who's interested in the field, or is just woke about mental health, or is just doing it for the gram, as simply put as I can. So having a quote is not mental health. Like, that is not mental health. Like, stop it right now. And I completely agree with you in terms of like, which ecosystem are we a part of is very important. And that's when being aware of what you're consuming and then stopping or actively unfollowing those pages.
Yeah, you make a very relevant point that realistically we tend to be really close to say 4 or 5 people, and those are the people that we can look out for, those are the people that we can check in with, on a weekly basis. And that's actually leading into the next question about what is the best way to support those 4-5 people.
Kriti, you want to take this first?
Sure, thank you. So I think my advice or my suggestion or my 2 cents would be, first, be aware of whether they're actually going through depression or sadness. And when I say that, I'm not saying disregard what they're feeling. I'm saying as a friend, as a spectator, as a third person in their life, you should be aware of the fact that, hey, are you going through a momentary phase which is of discomfort and sadness? Or has this been happening for a long time? So again, if we step back from that particular point as well, is you should know what depression is. You yourself should not know that this is, you know, this should not feel like, okay, after a breakup, you go through a depression. No, you don't. So you have to be aware of the fact that this is this momentary? What are the different nitty-gritties of why someone calls themselves depressed, or, you know, they're clinically diagnosed as a depressed person, a depressed individual? There are lots of ways you can find out. And this is a quick sort of exercise that, you know, I used to do when I was, you know, just hanging out with my friends and having a conversation with them. You ask really basic questions like, hey, do you feel like waking up every morning? Do you feel like you're a failure to your parents? Do you feel like going to your work? Do you feel like, you know, getting dressed and, you know, taking a photo of yourself? Those are very basic things which qualify. I mean, it's not a straight cut, okay, this is all fake, so you're not depressed. But it's just a sort of a conversation that you can start in terms of, hey, are you aware of the terminology you're using? It's very easy to say that you're depressed, but actually going through that takes a lot of time and effort. So, you know, as a friend, I would encourage people to be very mindful of the terms that are used, because, you know, we are aware of mental health, but we're also aware of using them just to sound cool or sound woke. The second thing, you know, when there is someone who's depressed, the most important thing is to listen to them. You know, you don't have to say, hey, it's going to be fine, it's all going to be okay. It's not. Like, someone who's going through something that has made them or led them to that emotional state, saying it's going to be fine is not going to cut it. So sometimes you can just sit in and listen to them. And then I would say, support them, but also connect them to individuals who might have training in working with, you know, mental health diagnosis. You know, making them aware of the fact that, hey, there are people you can talk to professionally. And this also speaks to a little bit about normalizing sessions in therapy.
And I really resonate with the fact when Kriti comes and tells us that, well, sure, you can't always tell them it's all going to be fine and perfect and it's going to be absolutely beautiful. But again, there's another angle to this, that perhaps for school students and teenagers, I think access to professional help is something that's almost non-existent. Especially because many a time the problem starts from home, and many a times the entire cause of the problem starts from home itself. Sometimes that isn't really possible. But I've noticed, at least in my own personal experience, that people do come with issues and they want to talk about it, even if they just want to vent about it, even if they just want to listen. Certain patterns arise. Sometimes it's always the same thing that keeps nagging them. Sometimes it's always the same problems they're facing over a couple of months, perhaps, in very isolated episodes, but still, there's some sort of a pattern that arises. We see amongst people in my peer group, they always believe that, okay, let's just hear them out, say it's all going to be fine, and let that be. And the next time it happens, repeat the same thing. But what I've at least seen, at least in my personal experience, is that you need to get down to what's actually causing it. A very simple example, a friend of mine had years of issues with dealing with just maths. And that's a really big issue when you're in high school. When you can't do maths, everyone's telling you that, hey, you've got brilliant grades in every other subject. What's up with maths? Mm-hmm. Are you dumb? No, you aren't dumb. You can do it. You understand what's happening, but you can't perform it. And when you're looking at this entire aspect of it, there was this one incident where he had one incident back in his childhood when he was in class 5, and his parents kept nagging him about just not getting 2 marks in a math. And from there, he had this entire buildup of emotions where he was like, I'm not going to do maths because I'm averse to the fact that people will have me. And sometimes you've got these underlying issues which people face, and maybe you can probably lay it out in front of them, because sometimes they're just clouded in their judgment. They don't realize that perhaps their issues have an underlying reason. And sometimes just as a friend, as a bystander, you can actually see through these issues. And I think it's important to lay it out in front of people and let them know, at least they can make an informed choice. I think there's a good chance, at least from my personal experience, that most of us just react to the issues that we faced. We never really decide to respond. So we are just reacting at a very momentary basis. We're not really responding at the larger level that, hey, if this is happening 5 times a month, it's probably something else that's causing it. And I think that's also important to look into it. But again, I absolutely agree, professional help in this case will be the most important, but may not be the most plausible situation, especially when we're looking at teenagers in India. I think that's still an accessibility issue that we still have.
No, you make a very interesting point, because as friends, you do have a ringside view of their life. And you can see certain patterns that, you know, they may not be able to see themselves. But Kriti, I think this one is for you. At what point do you say, I don't know how to help you? Because after all, we are talking about teenagers over here. And there may come a point where I'm going through something and I don't have it in me to support my friend, no matter what a rough patch she is going through, or, you know. So when do you say, I don't know how to help you? And how do you say it?
That is something that's a really relevant conversation to have, in terms of being, again, authentic as a helping or a supportive friend. But before that, I also want to have a conversation about what we just spoke about. I think that sort of what I'm getting a sense of is that, you know, there's a friend circle or a group where people are aware of what they're going through, or people are aware and they are high functioning in terms of understanding the pattern that they're going through, or one friend is understanding the pattern that the other friend is going through. And in saying so, then it's evident that one friend has the ability to look at it from a bird's eye point of view, look at it from a third person point of view. Why that becomes or might become a problem is when your friend is as intertwined in your life and emotionally biased. That's when the pattern gets hazy and you can't see it. So that sort of ties me into the question that, you know, we are talking about right now, in terms of when do you say, hey, this is not something that I can take care of anymore, and, you know, I can't help you. And you said it rightly, in terms of, at the end of the day, they're all teenagers that we're talking about. There is a certain level of sensibility that's yet to come, for natural reasons. And for experiential reasons. And I think at that time, it's important for the friend, or for the human, or for the, you know, teenager, to look inwards in terms of, hey, what's riling me up currently? Why can't I think through a solution for this person? Am I burnt out trying to be a friend that always needs to give in that help, to give that help to another person? Am I getting burnt out in that situation? And it's okay to address that, and it's okay to take a step back and say, hey, I want to be able to help you, but here's why I can't. And I don't want to throw that on you. I don't want to put my baggage on you as well, but this is just somewhere that I need to draw a line. So to recognize that, you have to be able to be very attuned to your own self. Or it can be, as Parikshit was saying, seeing the pattern in your life and seeing, hey, we are having this conversation constantly. And I was helping my friend, you know, all this while, and it was okay with me, and I didn't, you know, there was no block in my head. Suddenly, what happened that I can't think of something concrete enough to help that person with? What happened? What changed? What was that trigger for me? And then you see a pattern emerging in your life as well. And then that's where you step back and say, hey, this is somewhere that, you know, the lines are getting blurred, and I'm getting way too involved in this conversation for me to be able to help you. And I just want to add, when there's an emotional quotient that adds on, the quality of work that you can do in terms of helping goes down. And as much as we would say, hey, that's my friend, that's my father, that's my mother, that's my sister, brother, whatever, and I feel for them, and that's why I want to help them, you do get tinted with bias. You do get tinted with an emotional charge.
There's actually, there's a very fine line between empathizing with your friend and sympathizing with your friend. I want to just open this up to both of you. What is the difference, and what is the balance? What is the right balance?
I think the core difference, from how I see it, comes down to how much you actually know a person. I think it comes down to that. If I'm talking about a really close friend, I don't think I'll be sympathizing with the person if someone's telling me, maybe it's just a regular bad day that they've had or a regular fight with their parents that they've had. And that's really common. And I think that's where you get an element of empathy coming in. And you probably mm-hmm. understand it because most probably you're feeling it as well, because you're almost leading very similar lives, especially if you're in the same school. If you're in similar school, you're in the similar grade, you really understand. And then you can get from that point of view and be like, this was the last time that I faced this issue. And perhaps we can deal with it together, or you can just have a look at how I dealt with it. In my opinion, it's almost like an escape route to be like, hey, I'm sorry for you. And I feel bad for what's happening. I'm sure it's going to be great, but I don't want to be part of this conversation.
I kind of feel the opposite. Looking at it from a counselor perspective, or just from the field, a professional in the field, empathy is a little bit higher than just being able to help somebody. And I want to like sort of give an analogy in terms of a design or like a diagram, which is like if you have a circle and then you have a circle on top of it. So the circle within it, that circle is sympathy, because that's the quickest reaction that you have for somebody. That's the quickest reaction. Oh my God, I feel so bad. Or, you know, you get so emotionally charged that you forget all the cognition, you forget all the experiences that you've processed, and all of that goes out of the roof. And that's the closest that you can react to some story, which is sympathizing, because you don't have to be going through the same thing to sympathize. You can just feel bad for somebody. You can just feel upset that this happened. I sympathize with kids from Israel, whatever. I can sympathize with anybody because it's a human sort of connection in terms of that. Empathy is a little bit higher in terms of I understand because I've put myself in your shoes. Empathy is bereft of that emotional charge. And in empathy, it's a little bit higher because you think of solutions, you think of helping that person, you think of all the things that maybe if you're in that position, what could you have done to get yourself out of it? So I almost say that, you know, sometimes empathy is selfish because it's like, hey, if I was in that position, should I need to get out of this? And how do I do that? So in that aspect, I'm going to help you. So it's not that it's bad. It's just that's how the thinking is. That's how different sympathy and empathy is. And frankly speaking, to help, quality help, I think empathy is the way to go. Sympathy just like will, you know, tint everything that's there in your head and like it will go jumble up. Empathy is somewhere that you can sort of think of a solution.
That's a really interesting way to put it, actually, that empathy is more to do with like your mind and sympathy is more to do with the heart. You know, we've spoken and Kriti has spent some time on talking about like the difference between depression and like being sad and being upset. I also want to actually just talk about the difference between depression and anxiety. I think these two words, particularly when it comes to mental health, are very are overused and often used synonymously also. So what is the difference actually? When is someone depressed and when is someone anxious?
I hope it's not used synonymously. For the profession's sake, I hope it's not. But just to maybe, I'm going to try not being as clinical, but depression is to do with feelings of emptiness, episodes of sadness, feelings of unworthiness, hopelessness, helplessness. These are the five things that are primarily the constitutions of what depression as a whole can be. Sometimes you can be a person suffering from depression, and sometimes you can be sad. Sometimes you can be hopeless. Sometimes you can be like, hey, I don't think anybody's going to help me. So there can be episodes under the umbrella of depression, but these are the five main things that constitute what depression is. Mm. Anxiety, on the other hand, is feeling like there's in layman's term, it's almost like there's always this I would not want to say this word, but there's always anxiousness, there's always this feeling of I'm going to lose something, I'm missing a plane, I'm missing a flight, I'm missing to do something. There's anxiety in that term. That's what anxiety is. So if I were to put it on a spectrum, if depression is here, then anxiety is somewhere here in terms of the emotional quotient. Because in depression, there's almost like a flat effect. There is no emotion. There is no sort of like ups and downs You know, that's not what depression is. Depression is like there's a flat line, helplessness, hopelessness, sadness. Anxiety is you get a high, you get a low, you get a high, you get a low. It's, you know, stagnant. You can be nervous, and that's a low form of anxiety. Like, you know, I'm panicking and I'm you know, rubbing my nails and I'm nervous about something. And a high form of anxiety is when I'm like having a fit, I'm throwing around things and I'm angry and I'm aggressive. That's what anxiety is. That all constitutes under anxiety. When I'm having a panic attack, I'm throwing things, I'm hitting things. That's a high of anxiety. So anxiety, if I were to put it, if I put both in sort of like a linear method, like depression is flat, anxiety is up and down, up and down. So that's mainly the difference between depression and anxiety.
Parikshit, how much support do you get from your school and your family when it comes to depression? And where else do you look for support?
I think this is exactly what I was going to ask Kriti right after this, because at least within the peer circle, this is not something you can handle by yourself, especially if you're having it at a more extreme level. If you're looking at schools, I think schools are making an effort on paper, but there's really no effort that's actually being put in. I'll just tell you what happened today in the morning. For two periods of the entire school, since I think one teacher was on break, we had the school counselor come over. It was 50 students and one counselor. And they were all that they were discussing was the screen time that we have on our phones every day. And my point is, if that's the discussion you're having about counseling in school, then that's probably not the discussion we actually need. Because especially when you talk about depression and anxiety, the fact that you have to get to reach out to a counselor in school also is an intimidating thing, especially because let's not talk about online learning. Let's talk about physical schools. You have to go into the counselor's office, be seen by 2,000 kids on the field during a break time, and be seen that you're going in there, even if it's to discuss something or maybe even to ask, how do I approach you in the future? Maybe I don't need it right now. There'll be questions that'll be raised. So I think that's something that schools are trying to do just on paper, but there's really no actual effort to be ensured that, okay, people can actually approach the counselor. Because in my experience, I've only seen one person in my entire school life actually approaching the counselor. And when the counselors come to a classroom and they start taking a 40-minute session, it's all about how to do well in your exams, how to study better in your exams. And talking about the family spectrum, that's completely different ballgame. That is very subjective, comes down to who your parents are. Most of the time, your family is the reason why you're having the issues that you're facing. And that's something that's really prevalent, at least in my friend circle and with most teenagers around the city and around probably the country as well. So I think the effort is being made just to show that there is an effort, but there really has to be a mechanism to get there and ensure that there is an ability to reach the help. And I really wanted to ask Kriti that, hey, what can we actually do as friends when we... Perhaps we can't do something to solve it, but what can we do when we see someone who's actually facing such issues, or how do we go about it?
And, you know, honestly, I understand the background of it. There might be funding issues. There might be just systemic, you know, archaic educational systems that we have to sort of start having real conversations about. I know that, and that's like a higher ball game altogether. But I think that's where institutions and, you know, sectors such as educational, technological ventures, such as Open House, you know, other sort of learning centers come in. Because that's when there's going to be an organizational need for having counselors on board and on floor. And this is an analogy that I do with a lot of my conversations. It's like you're in a gym, and there are like on floor instructors. You don't know what you're doing, go to that instructor and they'll tell you. They don't have to like run around you behind your back and telling, you know, to tell you all and each and every exercise, but they're always there. So you know that, okay, there's somebody there to take care of my, you know, physical health if I really need it. Similarly, having, you know, counselors or just mental health practitioners in an institution such as, you know, an educational firm, where you know and you're identified as being a counselor, and that students can go to you, they can take a break from their class for 5-10 minutes, they can quickly have a chat with you, and then you guys can, you know, take it forward. So having those people on board, so that I think the other aspect is also, how can you as an institution, how can you as a student in that institution sort of call for a change in mental health, in the way mental health is perceived? And I think you sort of touched upon that in terms of like nobody was listening, because we didn't have that, want to have that conversation. It's when, you know, students, high school students, 11, 12, 10, they go about, you know, they go to the counselor and say, hey, this is what we want to talk about. We don't want to talk about it screen time, and not be disrespectful about it, but genuinely just be like, hey, if you are here to help us, this is what we want to talk about. Go talk about that. You know, instead of shutting down and say, I don't want to listen, just take your phone and do whatever. That's not helping the situation. Yes, yeah. I know that you guys agree and see a problem, but what are you doing? I also think from a school perspective, guys, like 40 kids in one counselor, that doesn't help.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
That's not cutting it. And I remember
when
I
was 50, in
school, yeah. Yeah, 50. I remember when I was in school, we used to have life skill education, LSE period, classes and periods. And they used to teach us about good behavior. And, you know, now that I look back, I'm like, this is not cutting it. This was LSE, like, this is what you're going to teach us. Like, it was not cutting it at all, but
good behavior. I think that, LSE classes. Yeah. Was
oh yeah,
good
we've
behavior.
Had it entirely. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, we still have it.
Good behavior, value bad education. Behavior, value education classes. Education, there was nothing like what we used to do. Honestly, in value ed classes, do history homework.
Yeah, that's, entirely. That's our value ed teacher is. It's not a value ed teacher. It's another subject teacher who comes and fills in the class and says, "Do whatever you want." Because I can't teach 17-year-olds what is gratitude. Because that's what you're supposed to teach in value-ed class. They teach students about gratitude.
Wow.
And that's not something which you teach a 17-year-old. You just like do whatever you want.
Exactly. So I think schools have really
had it. Yeah. I think schools have really had it easy all this while. Because even Kriti, I hear you when you're saying the idea is not to say I'm not going to pay attention, but to say this is what we're going to talk about. But what people want to talk about is not something that can be spoken of in a class of 50 people. And more than that, I think there's another element to it. As you were saying, that you were asked to sit in the staff room and fill in for teachers who weren't there. I think that's exactly what happens in all our schools. And that's exactly what happens in my school. That happens in most of our schools. And when a teacher's absent, which is probably what happened today as well in the morning, when the teacher is filled in and tried to talk to a bunch of 50 people whose cameras are off, muted mics, put on a screen, put on a PowerPoint presentation or screen share and started talking about what is digital well-being. And nobody responded to anything that's happening. So even if you want to have those conversations, it cannot happen in a class of 50 people. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, in a physical school form, at least what I see happening around us, if even if you've sort of booked an appointment with the counselor, you're called from your class to go to the counselor's office during class hours. When all 50 of your students are seeing that you're being called, that again doesn't work. So not only are you taking the step of going and approaching the counselor to have a conversation, you're being called out of your class. You're probably having a math class and being called out to go and have that conversation. And that's really not something. And when one person faces that, I'm sure the rest of the 49 students will be like, hey, I don't want to be called out of class.
Yeah, I'm not doing that.
For a reason where we know what's happening. Yeah. I think there's also systemic advantage that's already there. If you're talking about 7 and 8 kids, or just perhaps not the senior most classes in a school over here, because I've seen this happening in all sorts of extracurriculars and academic pursuits where we would normally go to a senior and we would talk about, hey, these are the issues that I'm facing and can you help me out over here? What's happening? And that's something really happened. I think I've seen many of my juniors reach out to me with many of the issues that they are facing, they see their friends facing, primarily because perhaps they don't understand what's happening. And perhaps I am in that position of, dare I say, some sort of a position of authority that I have over them as someone who's like 2 years older to them, 2 years older to them. I've probably navigated the same issue. It's probably down to just failing an exam and to be able to deal with that, or maybe to be able to deal with, say, a class 10 board exams, which I've given. And perhaps that level, that perspective is something that's really important and can actually help a lot of times. Normally, when we talk about peer circles, it's always people of the same age group. But there is a level higher than that. I think we reach out to our seniors for apart from mental health. And perhaps the other people can be the people who can really guide you through the process because they've probably gone through the same thing. So I think that perspective is something that's important. And I've also come to realize that something that I say to a junior, if a junior's classmate says the same thing to them, I think that'll be better received from someone who's a little more respected in terms of that, hey, this person's always been there for me, has helped me for so many things. Perhaps this one's also going to be true. So I think there is a systemic advantage that exists, but I think that's something that hasn't extended to mental health yet.
Oh, that's very interesting, actually. I think that brings us to the close of our conversation today. And I mean, we've gone from talking about Instagram algorithms to, counselors in school. I think like one of the things that when Parikshit was talking about having created a safe space within peer groups, I think the first thing that I actually thought of was that vulnerability is always a two-way street. And I think that's really easy to do for all of us to like open ourselves up in the hope that the person in front of you will also perhaps share. If there's anything you guys want to add as just closing remarks, then go ahead.
I definitely actually agree with the fact that vulnerability is most definitely a two-way street. But I also just want to add that, hey, if you are opening up and then you see another person is not, it's cool. It's okay. Mm. Not a problem. Don't be vulnerable with an expectation that you're going to get some back, you know, get some sort of like in their life back. It's fine if people don't want to. And just maybe to close this session off, I genuinely want to, I mean, firstly, I had a great time talking to Parikshit and Sitika. I think we spoke about a lot of interesting, relevant gaps in the society, in an institution, and systemically where we can place ourselves and change the way that we are reacting to it so that we can change like a bigger string somewhere. And that sort of gives me fuel to go back to my job and do it better next time that I'm, meeting a client or meeting a 12th grader. So yeah, definitely. I had a great time talking to both of you, and I wish to do this further.
Right. And I think I'm really going to thank Kriti also for this entire thing, because I've got a lot more perspective from where I started with an hour back. But then I think even talking about opening up, one thing is you just can't go and open up to any random person. Because I think when people say open up, they take it the wrong way and they start opening up to everyone. And that's where the issue of sympathy versus empathy comes in. And you just sympathize and leave it there. And that's when you're disappointed. But apart from that, I think I had a great time. I'm really praying I don't get pulled up in school for saying what I said over here.
But thank you so much for a lovely conversation. And I hope this is valuable to everyone who tunes in.